One for Mum, one for Dad, and one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be an Australian.
Budgets are about choices, Fran, and you show what you value through the choices you make.
Dead, buried, cremated.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
How good is Australia?
Just follow the money.
G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Institute, and today we're bringing you more guests from our 2020 webinar series. Aged care was thrust into the spotlight in 2020, with more than 1,000 COVID cases and a tragic 600 deaths taking place in residential aged care facilities in the midst of the pandemic. But even before the global pandemic hit, all was not well in Australia's aged care system. In 2018, a royal commission was established into aged care quality and safety, following a series of shocking and horrifying scandals, and, as is so often the case, a powerful report on ABC's Four Corners. The Royal Commission's interim report in October 2019 did not hold back, saying that aged care services are fragmented, unsupported and underfunded, and that, quote, with some admirable exceptions, they are poorly managed. All too often they are unsafe and seemingly uncaring.
I'd rather be dead than live here. That's the shocking claim from an elderly resident in an Australian nursing home.
The aged care sector is simply not sustainable under its current funding levels. That's the evidence that's been presented to the Royal Commission.
Why is the Prime Minister arrogantly persisting with an aged care minister who clearly should be sacked from his job?
Will there be more deaths amongst our elderly residential aged care population because of COVID-19? The answer is yes.
There were repeated calls for the government help from Melbourne aged care facility that's had the largest outbreak in the country. At one stage, the home had just one staff member for every 19 residents.
We spoke to over 1,000 aged care workers and, many of them were saying they hadn't been prepared. 3 out of 10 said they hadn't done any specific training for COVID-19.
Where there are breakdowns, where there are issues, I want to know about them. And I want to know about them and I want to fix them.
Very, very disturbing undercurrent in Australia as we debate the cost of COVID and the cost of dealing with COVID. A discussion that's been along the lines of, well, these people are almost dead anyway. Why are we freezing the economy to keep them alive?
So to discuss how Australia got into this mess, we spoke to Jed Carney, the Federal Member for Cooper and Shadow Assistant Minister for Aged Care, Beres Campbell, who has been involved in residential and home-based care for over 40 years, and who's the main driver for Home Share in Australia, a program that brings together older householders with people of integrity prepared to lend a hand in return for affordable accommodation. And we also spoke to Ruth Kesterman, CEO of Holdsworth Community, which provides community support across Sydney, in particular its eastern suburbs. This was recorded live on Wednesday, the 16th of September 2020, and things may have changed since recording.
Jed Carney, thank you so much for joining us today. We're going to start with you. Mm-hmm. Would you mind giving us a bit of the history that has shaped our aged care system from your time as a nurse to now being the Shadow Assistant Minister? What have been some of the big changes and trends that you've seen over this time?
Thanks very much. And Ebony, can I start by acknowledging that I am on the land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, and I pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging. And I'm glad you started your commentary by saying that what's happened during the pandemic has really highlighted some severe systemic problems that have existed for a long time that many of us have been fighting to change. Ever since, my entire life as a nurse and in the union movement and at the ACTU, we've been arguing for a better system for aged care. And I found it absolutely astounding that that the federal government seemed to be trying to abrogate responsibility from this the outbreak, when clearly this is squarely on the shoulders of the federal government. I remember Scott Morrison saying, or the Prime Minister saying, you know, what did you want me to do? Put a force field around aged care? Well, yeah, you should have put a force field around aged care, absolutely. We knew from the Dorothy Henderson outbreak and the Newmarch House outbreak in New South Wales, everything that really needed to be done to protect the elderly, who we knew were most vulnerable, from around the world. You just said, look, all around the world, we knew that the pandemic was going to hit our elderly in greater proportion to the rest of the population. So there should have been a force field put around aged care. And you just have to look back at the history, as you say, to see exactly where that force field needed to be put and what it needed to consist of. I'm old and I've been around a long time, and so I remember back before the 1997 Aged Care Act was written, and aged care was funded differently and it was run differently. It was much more involvement with state provision of services. There was the funding system recognised the need for there to be funding for capital works as well as care works. There were requirements of different skill levels of people working in aged care facilities, from nurses, carers, and doctors, et cetera, the care that needed to be given. Over time, there's been a lot of change since the Act was written, really. The funding model has changed dramatically. We know that bonds came into the picture, which made it very attractive for people who manage money. It became an interesting investment for people who saw it perhaps as a wealth management sector rather than a care sector. We had the for-profit sector coming in heavily. We had, I remember nursing homes where people actually would drive up to come home. People were that well when they went into residential care. Of course, it's changed now where people are wanting to stay much more at home, and we'll talk a bit more about that, aging at home and how we can help that. And that residential aged care facilities have really become more end-of-life care, very complex care, people with dementia, multiple morbidities, people requiring that really intense end-of-life and perhaps even palliative care. We've seen states pretty much exit the system. In Victoria, there are still some state-run facilities. In Queensland, I think there may be some, but by and large, it's run now by the not-for-profit sector and the for-profit sector. And, of course, there are some services that are run by local governments, but, again, this is also patchy across the country. In Victoria, we still have some local governments, and I'm not sure, I think maybe New South Wales, but that is quite patchy, the provision that is provided there, and, of course, it's funded differently, which I know is a concern for HANSA. We've seen a massive shift in how nursing homes or residential aged care facilities are staffed. There's massive problems with the workforce. They are low paid, predominantly female. There's part-time, casual. We even have in some facilities zero contract hours. Like employment is an issue in the sector, which of course has presented a lot of problems for the pandemic because people have to work across multiple facilities to make a living. There's no minimum staffing level requirements, no skill mix requirements, no minimum qualification requirements. I think that is something that really needs to be addressed, and that is an issue. And, of course, a huge issue that's been in the media recently is the lack of transparency and accountability with government funding. They do have to acquit some ways, but certainly not to the level that I would expect anyone who is funded to the level that the sector is funded with government taxpayers funding. There should be more acquittal and accountability for that. Very little public reporting around maintenance of standards. And the last thing I want to say about residential aged care is that we need a regulator and a compliancy model that has teeth, that can actually make a difference for the sector. And I think that we really need to look at how that is written. There was a very, very interesting article in the Saturday paper written by Rick Morton that, if anybody would like to have a look at, gives a very good analysis of the changes in aged care over time, quite in depth. So what we see now is a very sector that has been taken over by, been lost control from the state. We have a federal government that says we just fund it. You know, we don't really have a role in delivery anymore, which I would argue strongly that is not the case. They really do have a role in maintaining standards, monitoring and compliance and accountability and transparency. We also know that there's been a big shift in people wanting to stay home and age at home. And I think we have, I think, about 150,000 people waiting for home care packages. Tens of thousands of people have died waiting for their package at home. It's very, very difficult to get your package reviewed if you are ailing and getting needing more and more care over time. The issue with home care packages is quite serious, and I know this is another thing that HANSA has been looking at. We need to really rethink the model, in my view. We need to be innovative. The Royal Commission, as you said, entitled their interim report neglect. That is not a word anybody wants to hear when they are dealing with the aged care sector, if they have a loved one there. It's a real indictment on the sector, and it needs really serious review. And we need to be innovative, and we need to be thinking outside the box. I've got a few ideas, but I know that our other panellists, our other guests, will be focusing on that. So is that okay as a bit of a
Yeah, that's perfect. Thank you so much, Jen. And I think we'll come back to a couple of the issues that you've raised there, but that was kind of a good big picture overview of where the sector has gone awry. I'd just like to give a shout out to everyone who's joined us today. We've got 623 people participating. So thank you all for joining us. Ruth Kesterman, we'll come to you next. Your organisation, Holdsworth Community, provides care to older Australians in their homes across Sydney. Can you introduce us to how this system works and if there's been any changes to the way you operate? And I guess what people will be interested in is how the pandemic has affected your team and the people that you work with.
Absolutely. Thanks, Ebony. And yeah, I'll take the opportunity to also acknowledge the traditional owners of the beautiful land that we work on at Holdsworth, the people of the Eora Nation, and pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging. Holdsworth's been a really integral part of the community for more than 75 years, and we are really passionate about helping older Australians to stay living in their own homes and as really active members of their communities for as long as they want to, basically. So we really welcome this conversation and I guess the attention it's getting, and it's long overdue. The pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic has only increased, we've only seen an increase in people's determination to stay living at home through the final stages of their lives. And unfortunately, what we come across and what we're supporting people in is a system that we see does funnel people into residential aged care. Just to give a brief overview of I guess some of the barriers that we see people face who want to stay living at home and who need support to do that. The federal government system is called the My Aged Care system. It's a telephone internet-based system. It's very complex to navigate for any of us, let alone those who live with dementia, might be hard of hearing, or, for example, who English is not their first language. That's the first barrier for people, their families. It's complex to access. Now, when they do access, they are assessed for different levels of support, so different complexity of need. There is about 15% of the aged care funding goes to really low-level supports. So they might be community-based supports like shopping and outings, transport. Now, if you have high-level supports, you then are given the option to apply for a home care package or get a place in residential aged care. So what we see is that 65% of the funding goes towards residential aged care and less than 15% to home care packages. So really, if you want to stay living at home, you're competing for a much smaller amount of money. And Jed mentioned the waiting lists, more than 100,000 people. So really, you know, there are huge barriers to even access those packages. The other thing we're seeing is what you also alluded to is the commercial system that has been set up. So the federal government talks about it quite openly as a free market system. It is described as a consumer-directed care system. So we see older people, we talk with them and their families, they are set up as consumers in this model. Now, again, we're talking about people who might have been waiting for a very long time for a package. They may have very complex needs. The reality of them, having the information and the capacity and the time to shop around as a consumer for a quality provider is just, it's not always realistic. At the same time, there are a lot of providers out there. Jed also mentioned that it's an open market. There's for profits, varying levels of quality. I think the government has set up this model to regulate quality based on the fact that it's consumer driven. So people can choose their own provider, move providers if they're not happy. And they think that will regulate quality, but the reality is it's not. We see many older Australians with a home care package provider that's not delivering quality and is not giving value for money. So I guess that's where we see the great opportunity to offer more individual, personalised supports for older Australians. I think community organisations like Holdsworth, not-for-profits, who are integrated as part of the community, I think we have a lot to offer. Programs like HomeShare, which I know Beres will talk to more, they not only respond to the individual needs and preferences of older Australians and their families, but they tap into the existing assets that we have in our communities. And the result is great outcomes for individuals, but also cost savings for government. Some of the supports will have been proven that participants will be less likely to present at hospitals, they'll be less likely to use emergency services. We all know social isolation generates health issues. So some of these innovative, flexible, individualised supports can really be not only effective for the community but also cost-effective for the government. Around COVID, we've seen a huge increase in demand for our informal supports and our different programs like HomeShare. And I know Beres will talk more about that as well. But we're just so pleased that this conversation is happening here and in many other forums.
Thanks very much, Ruth. And that does take us to you, Beres Campbell. We've talked a little bit about HomeShare now, but there's probably many people who are on this webinar who may not have heard about that as a concept. Can you explain what HomeShare is and why it's important to the aged care sector?
I'm thrilled to be doing this, Ebony, and I'd like to really just say how totally gobsmacked I am that here we are all talking about a hot topic for the first time in my entire career, being aged care. Wow. I never thought I would ever see it, but it is fantastic to have aged care front and centre in a really positive way. And I mean, I know a lot of the talk is really critical, but it's so positive that we're even talking about it and that we're really trying to say, wow, we've got to do this better. We can't go backwards. And if we do go backwards, we've got to go back to what was good, because we did do some really, really good stuff. And as an elder of the aged care industry, I'd really like to sort of have a shout out for the fantastically creative work that set up what is now an aged care industry. It wasn't an industry when I was a bright, cheery new social worker back in the 70s. And, you know, back in that time, the drive for helping people just age well at home and stay at home and stay in their communities all came from the community, from people wanting to help each other, from volunteers who delivered the meals, who came into the nursing homes and, you know, became involved in the life of the home. And I was really most fortunate in being in a fabulous community of Port Melbourne, which is a place, you know, almost unique and special but in the whole sort of area where we built local government services in aged care back in the 70s and 80s, there was incredible community development and community engagement that brought out the best of people. And I've got to say that one of the good things about the pandemic, and of course lots of people have commented on this, is a bit of resurgence of that old sense of being good neighbours and looking out for each other. And a program like HomeShare really fits into that mould extremely well, because the best HomeShare programs are ones that are really embedded in their local community, where the people trust and know the organisation that's running it. And so I'm having a huge struggle in my old age of coming to terms with the commercial world of the aged care sector and the whole sort of competitive, non-cooperative way of working. I just find extraordinarily hard to work with. And so that pricing models and pricing lists and getting your service billable hours is just a really big issue in terms of bringing back into the sector a sense of passion and wanting to really see the community work with its older residents in a respectful and dignified and engaging way. So that's my rant for the day.
Yeah, I will ask you specifically though, what is HomeShare?
So HomeShare is really about two people helping each other. A home householder, who can be an older person, or in our programs at HomeShare Melbourne, we're broadening the householder range to include people with disability, people who've just got spare rooms in their home who would like to help someone who's at a disadvantage. But essentially, it's about a householder who's got room to spare being matched up with, and carefully matched up with, someone who would like to live with them and to maybe do some service or provide some companionship in return for a low-cost rent, or engage in a mutually beneficial way, because there are advantages for both. And the HomeShare program managers and coordinators are involved in making sure that people come together safely and carefully to ensure successful matches. And that's what we've been really working on for the last 20 years. And HomeShare is not new. It's been around, and particularly in this sort of agency-assisted form of service. It sprung up in the 70s in the United States and passed across the Atlantic to the UK in the 90s. And then we got to hear about it in the late 90s. And it's been growing now over the last 20 years and is now in about 17 or 18 countries. So, you know, it's a movement that's been gaining momentum. And why is it gaining momentum? Because it actually works. It really does bring people together and it does strengthen communities. And so it's incredibly worthwhile initiative to promote. And the biggest issue in it is that it does need to be done well and done safely. And to do anything well, you've got to invest in it. And that's, of course, what we've been banging on government door and philanthropists' doors for the last 20 years, because to develop a program of this nature requires a very good, experienced practitioners who can do HomeShare well. And so my hope and our submissions to the Royal Commission is that we have now got a really strong conversation going with the commission, which I'm sure they didn't think they were going to get in this deep into the whole area of shifting the culture that is sitting behind aged care. And that's what we've really got to try and revitalise, a culture that's about really working cooperatively for the benefits of everybody, really, stronger communities. So that's my big bang for the day.
Thank you. And we'll move shortly to questions from the audience. But, I was going to say it is a different model, but you can see how it does solve multiple problems. Australia has a big housing affordability problem as well. So you can really see the virtues of a program that can, do multiple things at once. And, as a single person who lives alone with her cat, it's really nice to hear that there are options, that don't involve me mouldering away in an old residential facility in my old age, and that there are other options out there if I can't convince all my besties to come to the same aged care facility as me when they all retire. So I do think that's a really important thing to unpack and to know that there are other options out there to residential aged care. But a lot of the questions that we do have coming in from the audience now, and I think we've got about 650 people who've joined us, so a few more since the start, are about aged care, I guess, as a whole and what's happening to the funding and the regulation of that system. So we'll cover a couple of those questions first. Jed, I think this first one might be for you. It's from Megan Flynn. She is asking, where can we get an annual detailed analysis of the funds going into aged care from federal and state governments, as well as the fees paid by individuals, and get greater transparency about where all the money is going to, and I guess whether or not it's being spent effectively?
So the Department of Aged Care or Ageing, I should know that, shouldn't I? They do put out a report, an annual report, that is quite a detailed report about the sector. It has data in there about length of stay, which is getting shorter and shorter, the average length of stay, which is indicative, I think, of the complexities of people going into residential aged care. It does give the data that facilities have to give to the department about their financials, but I think what you find is that it's very broad, and it's very hard to dig down into that data and really see what is actually spent on care, what is spent on capital, what goes into profits, what is used to subsidise other parts of their business or their corporation. And this isn't only the for-profits. I mean, we saw with St. Basil's that amazing bit of information where the church owned the property and ran the nursing home, but the nursing home paid rent to the church that was way above market rates for a rental property of that price. So, and that sort of has come out with people investigating and looking around. So I think you can get a lot of information about the sector, but what concerns us is the actual really digging down, the transparency, the accountability of taxpayers' funding, how much is spent on food, how much is spent on staffing, and how much is spent on care. You know, when you hear about staff who are given one pair of gloves for the day and expect that is supposed to be their PPE for the day in the pandemic, well then, that is ridiculous. We all know that you're supposed to take your gloves off between each episodic care, between each patient, each resident, and yet that sort of detail is not really provided. I think we, as I think Ruth explained about My Aged Care, if you are investigating nursing homes where you might want to place a loved one, I have tried to do this with my sister-in-law and for my mother-in-law. You try to look for the local nursing home, it's not listed on the My Aged Care website under the name that's on the front gate. It's listed under the sometimes under the overall big company or corporation that owns it. And who would know that? I wouldn't know that. So, and I kind of should be in the know about things like that. It's very complex. The whole system is complex. It's very hard to find information out about an individual's facility when you are trying to work out whether or not you would like to use their services. It's the whole system really is geared towards protecting that provider's business model, the information, how they manage that business, rather than giving information to us so that we can make informed decisions. And Anthony Albanese has announced an 8-point plan to reform the sector, what needs to be done immediately, and high up on that list is transparency and accountability so that we can see very clearly where that money is spent and how it's spent, and publication of information about individual facilities, like everything that you would possibly need to know, from staffing levels through to how much they spend on food each day.
Yep. That does seem pretty important to know. Ruth, I think this next one might be for you. Helen Kilbar has, I've got two people here, Rose Reed and Andrea Wittick, with their hands up. Rose, I might come to you next. If you didn't intend to put your hand up, if you press that icon, I'll know that you didn't mean to raise your hand and ask a question. This next question is from Helen Kilbar. She says, self-management of HCP has been amazing for her mum, and she's been able to put together a team that has kept her out of hospital and safe and happy through COVID, but that very few providers encourage self-management, and those that do provide minimal consumer-facing tools. And her question is, what do you see as the future of self-management?
I think, Ruth, sorry, go for it.
I'll answer briefly. I think that's a great question, and I think it's, as we've talked about, it should be one of those really viable options for people who want to have a home care package. We talk about self-management, we talk about shared management for people who might not want to or have the capacity to entirely manage. You're obviously doing an amazing job for your family member, but, you know, those who might not have all the capacity, the time to do that. So having a range of options, as I said, that can respond to the individual circumstances of older Australians is really what we think should be the future. At the moment, I think, there's providers, the majority of providers are not open to that concept. They're not as concerned about outcomes for the individual, but as you said, you know, they've got a business model to run to, and unfortunately you lose the nuances on being able to have control over that funding, which is should be going towards services for older Australians, really.
Jed, did you want to add something to that?
No, I agree with Ruth. That's and I just saw somebody pop up there. I think self-management is important. And in a perfect world, you know, because we view them as consumers and not as people that just need care or as part of the community, I love that, Beres. I loved how you brought in the whole, this should be about building stronger communities. You don't have perfect knowledge sometimes. Do you find that, Ruth? Like, you don't really know
exactly.
You don't know really what you need. You're presented with a brochure and you think, oh, yeah, that sounds okay, but maybe... You know, I don't know what I'm trying to say. I'm saying sometimes you don't really, a person may not really be able to do that. That's why I think home share is a beautiful option, because if somebody is there with you all the time or is in the house, those little things, like maybe you didn't know that you needed assistance paying your bills online because it's the only way you can pay bills these days, you know, or and that you've got a young person in the house who can help you with the IT sort of thing and say, oh, it's okay, I can set that up for you, like, you know. That's was the biggest things that my mother-in-law had to overcome when her husband died, because he paid all the bills online and she had no idea how to do that. So,
yeah,
it's complex working out your own self-management needs sometimes, and I just think we need to be aware of that. Not saying that we shouldn't do it and it shouldn't be self-managed, but I think there needs to be an awareness that it can be hard.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think what people want and need is a trusted provider, someone that can advise them, walk alongside them, as you say. And yeah, we've seen home share as an amazing option for people, and layering on formal supports as well as having that informal, that person at home to keep them connected, to do small chores around the house, but then still getting that that home care package support on top of that. We have a couple, someone living with dementia, and that's working perfectly for her because she's still engaging, she's got that shared life, but she's also getting the clinical supports that she needs.
Yeah, that brings me to my next question, which is for you, Beres, and then Rose, I'll come to you after that. Thanks for hanging on there. This question is from Heather Lawson. She says, how can we get government to fund more home share programs across Australia? And perhaps you could give us an idea of how big home share is at the moment.
I wanted to also say that there's a really encouraging move coming out of the work being done by the Royal Commission, which is to finally bring together the Commonwealth Home Support Program and the aged care packages, which have been operating separately, which is sheer madness, because the objectives of that whole group of things is to really support people from early on in when they don't really need care and support. They need engagement to be less isolated. They need to be part of their community, and so that they can start with active ageing initiatives that have been part of the Commonwealth Home Support Program and move through a continuum as your needs and supports change through to the ultimate, you know, high levels of packaged care. And if you bring something like home share into the equation early on as a as an additional support to, particularly for people living alone, but also for couples where there's just need to support each other and the help of having, you know, another young, strong person to help lift someone up, or all of those elements. If home share comes into aging well, and I really like us to think about aging well as a continuum, not declining to needing care and support, but aging well, that you can start with initiatives like home share that are very normal things of just having people living together and supporting each other, and then build on those with additional paid skilled resources as you grow. And that's the most important underpinning philosophies that I hope will be really addressed, and the principles of doing that when the Royal Commission look at these proposals that are in the discussion paper for the current hearings, where they are looking to increase the change, the funding for the care, the home-based care sector. So, I mean, at the moment, there is no funding system for home share, which Heather Lawson's asking about. In Victoria, we really did really well because we had a really very strong and engaged aged care division in our state government department back in the noughties, and so that we were successful in gaining HAC funds back in 2009 to continue to grow and experiment with the home share program. But Victoria was the only state that did that. And we expanded that with the support of the aged care division in the HAC program in 2012-13, and which was growing really well across all of Melbourne. And then in 2015, the Commonwealth took over aged care, which from the Victorians' perspective was a real backward step, because Victoria was really doing aged care well, and particularly in its relationship between local government and the state government. so that we had strong networks of home hack services. And so it wasn't surprising for our home hack program to support the Home Share initiative. But it's lost its leadership since the Commonwealth took over, and which has been really frustrating. And there is a real need. That's why we're so keen to see Home Share acknowledged within the basket of services, because it does need to have an injection of funds to start it up. And then it can start to work towards being a fee-paying service. But you can't start a business without a seeding grant. And that's been a really inhibiting factor here in Australia.
Thanks, Beres. The next question is from Barbara Lyle, although I will just remind everyone, Rose dropped off there, but if you would like to ask the panel your question live, use the raise your hand function and I'll call on you in a second. Jed, this next question is for you from Barbara Lyle. How can we bring back a more regulated system with more fully trained nurses, a larger ratio of trained nurses to residents, and more transparency about how funds are spent? Well, that was kind of already touched on that.
Yes, well, the 1997 Aged Care Act pretty much removed reference to staffing levels and nursing care in residential aged care facilities, and didn't set any minimum requirements. So we've made it very clear that we, being the opposition, think that this is something that needs to change, that there does need to be minimum staffing levels. There needs to be a proper skill mix of people working in those residential aged care facilities. I don't think you'll be surprised, with me coming from my nursing background, that I would be very supportive of that. There was a view that, and it's, you know, going into a residential aged care is not just babysitting, and it means that you need care, and you need people who have a range of skills working there, not just nurses and carers, but also access to doctors, access to physiotherapists, occupational therapists, speech therapists. You know, there's a wide range of professionals that do need to access residential aged care facilities. How do we make sure that happens? Well, that's part of what the Royal Commission is looking very carefully at, and there's been lots of suggestions. And one thing that really appeals to me is the interface that we have with our public health system, which during the pandemic you'll notice has actually been one of the biggest cracks. Like, do we send people from residential aged care facilities into the state hospital? Don't we? Do we leave them in? There was a lot of confusion about that connection with our public health system, which of course is run by the states. It's not run by the federal government. I'm very attracted to a model that has a really good connection with our state hospitals. And in some areas, I hate to be provocative, I am from Victoria, but I do know that there are some models in Victoria with some of the hospitals who have units that actually go into aged care facilities and assist with the healthcare in those facilities. I mean, it's good for the hospitals because it means that residents don't get sent in an ambulance to emergency departments, and it means that they can help keep an eye on the medical and healthcare needs of the residents. So there's lots of different models being portrayed, but I think from a very basic level, we need minimum staffing levels and a minimum skills mix. Although somebody said to me the other day, but Jed, why would you be asking for minimum staffing levels? Surely you want maximum staffing levels. So there might be a little bit of need to nuance that language around that, but I think people watching this would know what I mean when I say,
yeah.
So, yeah, we've got to work on the language there. So that is definitely something that I think the Royal Commission will be putting a great deal of focus on.
Is there anything, Ruth or Beres, you'd like to add to that question about regulation?
Look, I just wanted to add that, and I see there's a lot of comments on questioning whether, you know, you can respond to high needs or complex needs in the home. And I think we should all challenge ourselves to see how we can do that. And I think we possibly haven't been as much because the funding is certainly weighted towards residential aged care. But we can see that it can happen with the right supports, with community nursing, those specialists out in the community, that can happen. And I'd like to see that being supported more so that we can actually see communities that have older people living amongst all the other groups in the community. So children can see older people around. They're not locked up in institutions, that really we get the benefit of them being part of our community. And yes, it might not be easy, might not be something we've done as much in the past, but let's try and do that. It's possible. It certainly is possible.
Ruth, sorry, Ebony, can I just quickly add to that? A lot of people have come to me and said something that would really help them would be day respite, and saying really be incredibly happy to have mum at home with a bit of support in the home, but I just can't leave her when I go to work. Mm-hmm. And I would love to be cared for perhaps somewhere in my community, mm-hmm. day respite type of situation, which with the stretch of the imagination wouldn't be that hard, I think, to establish. What do you think about? I'm interested. What do you think? Oh, Ebony, am I allowed to ask a question?
Yeah, go for it.
what do you think about that? That comes up all the time for me, for people in my community. I'd keep mum with me if I could have somewhere for her to go during the day.
Holdsworth, that's been the majority of the supports that we offer in our community to older people and their families. We often, it's not only the respite, I guess, or the opportunity for families to be able to work, etc., but it's also engaging older people with new friends, with their local community. We are quite committed to being out and about. We're not keen on a day centre model, and that is for people who live with dementia, wide range of people. Or it might be a safe environment where they can engage with other parts of the community as well. But that is absolutely possible, and definitely something that we hear a lot as well. Yeah. And I also think we have had as a society a big focus on productivity, and we're all working more, we're all busier. And the flip side has been that all these normal, informal supports we used to do and care for our family members or our neighbours, that's disappeared, and now we find we're paying for that, and seems to be a bit of a strange outcome of that. But I think we can definitely bring that back.
Home share can play a role in that too. And Holdsworth have got a really good example that featured on Compass. On the ABC's Compass program, where the householder really lived with her daughter, even though it was a big house and she had a separate wing. But she was really lonely in the day because the daughter and everyone went to work. And so, Wendy recruited a retired woman who lived with then as a home sharer and was able to be there or to take the older person out. So, that's another enormous value for home share.
Mm. And I see in the chat that those services do exist, and I acknowledge that, but I just think we don't invest in them broadly.
That's right, yeah.
That brings me to my next question, actually, that point that Ruth was making about, that a lot of care used to happen within the home, and was unpaid, and now we're finding ourselves having to pay for those services. So the next question is from Fred Sim, who asks, what are the panellists' thoughts on the ongoing major role played by the for-profit sector, in particular listed providers in the sector? If it's already underfunded, how can we realistically expect a good outcome if funds are being extracted for shareholders or otherwise? Beres, you've been in the aged care sector for a long time. What's your observation on the role of for-profit providers within the sector?
Gosh, it's a big topic, Ebony, because I do think that the big ones like Bupa, Australian Unity and Regis, and they're all highly motivated to provide wonderful accommodation and a lifestyle for people, and so that the values underpinning the commercial for-profit sector are fine. I think it's very difficult, though, to put monetary value on the sort of things that we're talking about, of engagement with community and, you know, keeping relationships front and centre. And I think that's particularly hard when you've got to keep, I mean, of course, you've got to keep your eye on the bottom line, but if you're also trying to keep your eye on the profits, it shifts the balance of how you think about and weigh up the options and how to go. I'm not a good person to talk to about running things for a profit, because I've never done it, and not very good at thinking about it. But I do think that it is possible, and it does really depend on the culture of the organisations and their relationship with their customers, and the sort of philosophies underpinning things, essentially.
Thanks, Baris. That brings me back to the last question that I wanted to ask you, Jed, before we wrap up. At the beginning, you talked a lot about some of the workforce issues that we've seen particularly highlighted from the pandemic, and moving from, you know, an area where there used to be minimum standards and, you know, staff to patient or nurse to patient ratios and things like that, and that now we're seeing 0 hours contracts, people having to work multiple jobs to make ends meet, and that in a pandemic that's actually been quite a weakness in terms of public health. But can you just reflect on some of those workforce issues, and I guess just thinking also about finding ourselves not just in the middle of a pandemic now, but in the first recession that Australia's had in 30 years, with hundreds of thousands of Australians out of work and the aged care sector being quite employment intensive compared to something like the mining industry. I think one of our senior fellows, Dave Richardson, calculated that you're 5 times more likely in the community to run into an aged care worker than a coal miner. It's very intensive in terms of employment, and that's what we need more than anything else at the moment, is to employ people. What are your observations on where we go from here in terms of fixing some of those workforce issues?
Yeah, I think that across the whole aged care spectrum, and I don't think my panellists would disagree with me, that when we are talking about increasing community work health in this sector, and as well as residential aged care workers, we really need to remember, when we're calling for consumer focused care and for self managed care, that at the end of that request there is a worker. Mm-hmm. And often the response to that type of approach has been people calling for the need for a very flexible workforce. So that, you know, if somebody says, oh, I really only need 2 hours of care a day in my home, somebody has to provide that 2 hours of care. And if that's the only 2 hours of care that they can provide, that's not a very good living for that person. So whilst I totally 100% support self-managed care, we have to have a system that also supports workers, that gives them the dignity of decent income and decent work. And that's hard. That's hard to do that. So I did notice in Hans's submission to the Royal Commission, you highlighted the need for minimum hours for workers, reliable jobs and steady income. Steady income is so important. If you don't have a steady income, you can't get a housing loan. You know, you find it even hard to get rent, to rent a property. You can't afford to buy a car or get a loan to buy a car, which means you probably can't go far to work, which then, you know, minimises the hours you can work because you can't get access to workplaces if you're in that system where you have to move around. So I think with community care and home care, we have to be really cognizant of the impact on workers if we are to move more into that area. In residential aged care, it's similar. We need minimum staffing levels. We need to minimise the impact, the need for people to work across different facilities, which means we need to offer them decent jobs. And that needs a lot of work. We need minimum qualifications, as I've said before. I think your comment about the future post-pandemic, I think I was really pleased today. I don't know if people saw in the media today, but the Labor Party have announced some initiatives that they want to take coming out of the pandemic. And the focus on the care economy is very strong. You know, it's a huge employment area, as you say, predominantly women. A lot of women work in the area and predominantly low-paid casual. And I think it's an area where if we really are thinking of stimulating the economy, then we need to focus on that, making sure that those jobs are well paid, that they're secure jobs, and that they provide quality services to the people who need them, the care of the services that are provided by people in those jobs. I think it's going to be massive. What, 150,000 people at the moment, is it, employed in the aged care? Does that sound about right? I think there's about 150,000 people, maybe more, maybe. Mm-hmm. Certainly if we are going to boost up quality of provision of care, then we're going to employ more people, we're going to need to train more people, make sure they have the skills and that they need to go into the sector, and it is going to be a huge stimulus opportunity. I hate to talk about aged care, Beris, in terms of economic stimulus, but
I know.
If you are, I mean, that was the frame of the question, Ebony. I think you're right, and this is an area absolutely that can help with that. Same with disability services and the public services that we offer broadly. I think the care economy, massive opportunity for us economically.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a growth industry.
It is there.
The care economy.
Yeah.
As long as the values stay strong and the culture is motivated by the care industry, not the financial industry.
Yeah. Well
Don't
said. I think we're going to have to wrap it up there, but thank you so much to all of our guests today. Jed Carney, Member for Cooper and Shadow Assistant Minister for Aged Care, Beris Campbell from Homeshare Australia, and Ruth Kesterman from Holdsworth Community. Thank you so much to all of you for joining us today. That was a really great discussion.
Thank you, Ebony. Thank you to everyone.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you to everyone who has joined us with their great questions. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all of them today, but hopefully you found that to be an interesting discussion. And please join us over the next few weeks for some more exciting webinars.
This has been a special summer episode of Follow the Money. All our webinars are free and available on the Australia Institute's YouTube channel. All our latest research and content is at australiainstitute.org.au, and we're on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. My Twitter handle is ebony_Bennett with a double N double T. This episode was produced by Jennifer Macy, and our theme music is by Jonathan McPheat from Pulse and Thrum. And remember, stay safe this summer, and thanks for listening.